Good evening. My name is Meg Stemler. I'm the producer of Live from the NYPL. I'm pleased to welcome you here tonight. I would like to first apologize for any inconvenience you experienced finding your way here. It will not happen again. Please note that after the program, you will be asked to exit South Court the same way you came in, but there'll be staff to direct you. Some live events to look forward to this season, all of these next week, are Slavoj Žižek, Edwidge Dentikat, Antonio Damasio, and Marina Abramovic. Tickets for the November 15th event featuring Jay-Z in conversation with Cornel West and Paul Holdengraber go on sale tomorrow at noon. Tonight's program will be filmed and telecast in real time by Fora TV. Become a friend of the library for just $40 and receive a 40% discount on each live ticket. Friends also receive free access to Fora TV telecasts. Please consider joining. It is your support that makes these evenings at the NYPL possible. After the conversation, the audience will be invited to ask questions. Two microphones will be passed around the auditorium at that time. Please speak clearly into the mic because this evening is being recorded. Following the program, Lady Antonia Frazier will be signing books available through independent bookstore 192 Books. Lady Antonia Frazier has written many acclaimed historical works, including Mary Queen of Scots, Cromwell, the Lord Protector, Royal Charles, Charles II and the Restoration, and Love and Louis XIV, The Women in the Life of the Sun King. We are honored to have her here this evening for a discussion about her most recent work, Must You Go, My Life with Harold Pinter. In Must You Go, Lady Antonia Frazier recounts the life she shared with the internationally renowned dramatist and Nobel Prize winner, Harold Pinter. The book is based on diaries she has kept since October 1968. Lady Antonia Frazier will be joined in conversation by Oscar Eustace, Artistic Director of the Public Theater. Oscar Eustace has worked as a director, dramaturg, and artistic director for theaters all around the country. At the Public, he directed the New York premiere of Ringgolf's The Ruby Sunrise and Hamlet. He commissioned Tony Kushner's Angels in America at the Eureka Theater Company in San Francisco and directed its world premiere at the Mark Taper Forum. Please join me in welcoming Lady Antonia Frazier and Oscar Eustace.
To be here.
Me too.
And what a good-looking audience, if I may say. Lady Antonia, this is an extraordinary book. It's beautiful, it's heartbreaking, it's smart, it's deft, and as an introduction to those who haven't had the pleasure of reading it yet, I wonder if you wouldn't mind telling us the story of your meeting with Harold Pinter that gives the book its title.
It was January the 8th, 1975, a date we subsequently celebrated for reasons that I hope you will discover. And I'd been asked to go to the first night of Harold's play, in revival, of course, in a sort of midtown theatre. It was the birthday party. And I went to it, and it was directed by my brother-in-law, Kevin Billington. And afterwards, he and my sister, Rachel, novelist, had a party at their house, which wasn't very far from my house. And I was rather disappointed not to be sat next to Harold. I thought he looked rather fascinating, sort of bright eyes, you know, and black curls, and sort of rather pointed ears, like a satyr, but I wasn't. And then my neighbours offered me a lift, and I said, well, hang on, I've not said hello to Harold Pinter all evening, and I must go and say, wonderful play, amazing actors. Thank you very much, blah, blah, blah. Thank you. And, you know, then I'll be with you. So I went up. Harold was actually sitting down, and I said, wonderful play, amazing actors, blah, 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 and now I must be off. He looked up with these black eyes and said, must you go? And I thought, must get up in the morning, take the children to school, must go shopping for groceries, must write King Charles II, you know. And and I said, well, no, it's not absolutely essential. And I stayed.
It's a perfect dramatic moment because your whole life could have swung on that choice.
Well, it's so interesting you should say that because afterwards we discussed what would have happened if I'd said, must get up in the morning and take the children, you know, and I'd sort of very nice to have met you, and if I had not stayed, and Harold being great romantic, because I think those who've read the book, those who will read it will discover, he said, well, we were destiny, you were my destiny, and we would have found each other some way. But I was more of the sort of, it's Robert Frost, isn't it? The Robert Frost point of view, that the road not taken. We'll never know, really. And so we don't know, but all I can say is you can understand that January the 8th was a day of celebration. He used to send me flowers, give me presents.
And that day actually ended about 6 a.m. on January 9th, if I...
Well, that was the advantage of that was that, depending on what was most convenient, we could celebrate it on the 8th or on the 9th or both.
Excellent. And what, I mean, he obviously you've described his looks. What else do you think were the thing that drew you two together so immediately, so quickly?
Well, Harold was an extremely magnetic man, you know, a strong will. I mean, there was something very... I mean, I think you don't achieve what he'd achieved. He was 44, I was 42. You don't, if you're sort of a languid personality, shall we say. No, he was very... he challenged authority when he was very young. And altogether, I think, sort of force.
And that force was attractive.
Yes.
There's a formulation that you use in the book about the relationship between a strong husband and a strong wife. Can you?
That was my brother, actually. My brother, Thomas Packenham. He started to give me a lecture. He came round, I think, to try and sort of... he may have been asked to try and make me see reason, whereas reason was the very last thing I was going to see. But anyway, we're very close in age, 11 months. We're like twins, Irish twins. And he began, he's very garrulous, and he began by giving a lecture about his own character and his own marriage, which is long and happy. And after a bit, I thought, well, you're supposed to be giving me a lecture. Come on, give the lecture. So he then said, well, it's very easy for a strong woman to get married if she wants to be married to a weak man, because that works perfectly. And it's very easy for a weak woman to get married if she wants to be married to a strong man. That, again, works perfectly. But if a strong woman wants to be married to a strong man, that is much more difficult to achieve. And I said, well, thank you, Thomas. I have achieved it. After which he went back to talking about himself.
You know, one of the beautiful qualities, I'm not the only person to remark on this, in this book, is that somehow it is tremendously revealing. We find out so much about you and about Harold Pinter, about your relationship, without ever feeling like it's falling into a confessional mode. And it's frankly bracing and inspiriting to read that. Talk about why. I mean, diaries.
I'm not at all a confessional person. In a way, I'm rather amazed at myself at having written the book, to be quite honest. But a friend of mine who was also interviewing me, like you, Amanda Foreman, you know, the writer, said she felt that she'd been sort of ushered into my house, which was a very nice thing to say. I mean, you know, but she said she, at the same time, she did not feel she was ushered anywhere she didn't want to go. I'm glad about that.
Completely correct. It is a tremendously welcoming book. It actually, although they're your diaries, they actually feel like they're constantly, I don't want to say outer directed, but they're at least embracing of the reader all the way through.
Well, it's at two levels, for those who haven't read it. They're my diary entries, and then my comments written in 2009 when I did the book. And various people have said, well, how much... they've meant this well. It's going to sound rude, but it wasn't meant rudely. How much of the diaries did you actually write at the time? I mean, this was curiosity. Right. And I said, there's something in me, the historian... I could do many things. I could invent many things, but I couldn't invent something in my diary.
Right.
I couldn't sit down and write a false account of a day or put in, you know, the Prime Minister rang up and asked me to form a government, nice as it might be, to have that invitation. And nor could I, much later, have invented things. So everything I say is in the diary, is in the diary.
Right. But it does, as you say, because there's the double time of the book, it also has the feeling of constantly being present with you in the composition of this specific book.
Yes, because I'm sort of reviewing it, you know. I started writing it a month after Harold died, and I have to say, because again, people have questioned this, I never, ever thought that I would write such a book. Well, it's back to the point. I'm not a very sort of professional, candid person. I'm more interested in writing about other people's lives. Mm-hmm. The more famous, the better. but a month, and of course, Harold never knew that I would write such a book. Again, I say that because it never occurred to me that anybody would think we had discussed it. But one or two people have asked me. But a month, he died on Christmas Eve 2008. And a month later, I was having lunch with an old friend, sort of cheer-up lunch, and he said, quite idly, "Antonia, do you still keep diaries?" And at that moment, it came into my head like that, absolutely. This is what I'm going to do. And I could hardly wait. I thought, thank you so much for lunch. And, you know, and I skipped out of the restaurant. It was very, very cold in January 2009, and we're going to get colder. And I got my diaries out with a view to starting the next morning. And that night I had to go and I'd been invited to dinner by my old friend, English publisher George Weidenfeld. And he invited me to the Wolseley, which is a lovely restaurant, but it's got one marked quality. You cannot hear one word that anyone says. So George was busy outlining plans for European culture, you know, and this, that, and the other. And I was nodding and saying, like that. And all the time I was thinking, 6 a.m., I'm going to get up in the dark and cold and I'm going to start. And so I did. And I started the next day and I wrote the book you see, first draft, in 10 weeks.
Oh, my God.
Which is not my usual rate of progress, I can assure you.
Oh, my God.
And it was like I was editing the diaries, as I went editing in the sense of obviously cutting out boring things. Sure. And I got masses of diaries. But and then I sort of revised it a bit. But basically, it was that 10 weeks.
And it's the presence of that editing voice that we were referring to before, that your constant re-reflection upon it, that gives a tremendous sense of unity to the whole thing. We feel present with you during those 10 weeks of the writing, and it gives, a marvelous unity to the entire enterprise.
Well, I'm glad you feel that. What I thought was that the best diaries are ones where the diarist allows us to see there can be a bit of an idiot, and I didn't cut out the occasions where I simply got things wrong, and there are quite a few of them. I left it in because that's what gives a diary its veracity, doesn't it?
Would you include voting for Margaret Thatcher among those things?
Well, Harold would. I didn't regret it, but I mean, I would include it because plenty of people voted for Margaret Thatcher in 1979. This was the first time, who afterwards denied it. But I'm not that kind of person. I thought it was interesting historically that two people like us, who basically were Lib Dem, Labour, and not Conservative, that we did vote in 1979. I think the record was important. I never regretted that vote. I never voted for her again. I never regretted it because I wanted to see a woman in number 10. Mm. And whatever she wanted. I don't think she wanted a bit to advance the cause of women. It wasn't her kind of bag. Mm-hmm. But she did. You see, after that, nobody could ever say you can't have a woman as Prime Minister, because it had one, just as when you have your first president, which doesn't seem to be imminent, I have to say. It will, whatever she is like, it will break the mould.
Although Sarah Palin did, I think, fly over to get a photo op with Margaret Thatcher recently.
Why did I Freudianly forget about Sarah Palin?
I can't imagine.
You're not going to say it's imminent.
No, I'm not. Although I did get very depressed. What did you make of our midterm elections?
Well, it's not really for me to comment. I mean, I was here.
Yes, I know.
And funnily enough, the last time I was here was November 2006. And somebody gave me a paperback copy of a book by somebody I'd never heard of, saying, I think you'll find this interesting. Mm. And that was Dreams of Our Forefathers.
Right.
And in 4 years... You know, it's extraordinary what's happened. I mean, I'm very interested in politics. I was reading everything this morning, but I couldn't quite... I was unable to divine the future, but perhaps you can.
No. But, you know, I mention it partly because there's a tremendously moving passage in here with the election of Obama and
yes,
how much it meant to both of you.
It was towards the end of Harold's life. He was sleeping more and more and really not doing very much in the daytime. And I was very keen on the whole situation and following it, as a tremendous lot of British people were. And I had to... It was the 4th, 5th of November, from memory, wasn't it? I think so, because I was... The reason I say that is because I was asked to go to the House of Commons to speak about the gunpowder plot, which the anniversary is the 5th of November. And the security in the House of Commons at that point was so great. I remember thinking if they'd had that security in 1605, you know, there never would have been a chance of a plot. But I spoke, and then I had dinner with some MPs, and when I came back, Harold was in bed asleep, but I stayed up, and... It was just the moment. I think it's Ohio when you realise that he must win, isn't it? If I got that right.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I rushed up, shook Harold awake, and said, we have to share this.
Oh, that's beautiful. It's, you know, actually, during the time that you and Pinto were together was the time when I studied Harold Pinter as a young man.
Yes.
He was in Martin Esslin's book, Theatre of the Absurd.
Yes, yes.
He was linked with Ionesco and Genet and Beckett. And in whether the title is correct or not, over the course of the years you were together, he became very outspoken politically. Mm. The work, in many senses, I'm thinking of Mountain Language, for example, One for the Road, became much more directly political. Mm. And in retrospect, even the earlier work started to look entirely different. And I wonder if you could talk about that evolution.
It's very interesting because when I first knew Harold, he said he wasn't at all political. And then he became political, and a lot of people have thought, and it's a fair inference, that it was me, you see, because I came from a political
sure.
background. Both my parents stood for Parliament. My father was a Labour minister over many years. My first husband was a Tory minister, so I've always been involved as an observer, part of politics. But I don't think it was that. For one thing, Harold was interested in Chile in 1973, 2 years before we met. And that could be said to be the influence of his great friend Peggy Ashcroft, a wonderful actress who was very prominent at supporting Allende. I think it was really that we do develop in our lives. We don't remain the same. And the introvert young man who was exploring certain issues changed, as one does, into exploring other issues, at which point Harold and indeed the critics started to discover that all his plays were political. And
right.
if you take a play like The Birthday Party, it seems to me that you can perfectly well argue it's a deeply political
Absolutely.
Party, a play right. about someone who challenges authority, Stanley, clearly in two different appalling kinds of authority.
Right.
Or you can say that's not what it means at all. And Harold... Really, basically, when people used to come up and say, what do your plays mean, said they mean whatever you want them to mean.
Right.
So that although he now said the Birthday Party was political, it was just to stop people saying, oh, well, you've never been interested in politics. I mean,
right.
I think he was more interested in writing the play than interpretations of it. That was, right. after all, for directors, you know.
Right. But then he said that beautiful thing in that Nobel Prize speech about the difference between literary language and political language.
Mm.
And I'm paraphrasing terribly, but to the extent that ambiguity and uncertainty and divided meanings are the province of the literary language.
Of the artist.
Of the artist.
But yes.
Precisely those things cannot be the province of the politician.
Yes, the citizen, actually. The way he contrasted the artist and the citizen and said, but they can be the same person. The artist is also a citizen, and then he has a different duty. I think it's a wonderful speech, actually. All that early part puts it so well.
It's an amazing speech, and of course it received quite a lot of condemnation in the United States as well as other places. And you smile, and I suspect that's what you did at the time.
Yes, I think if Harold was going to be bothered about condemnation, he would have been a very different person.
One of the beautiful strands in the book that you've woven through, and again, with a tremendously delicate touch, I can't quite explain, for those of you who haven't read it, how inviting the book is, because every point is landed on in a way that allows you to take it and receive it and move on to the next point without ever feeling like you're being manhandled in any way. But the way your Catholicism weaves through the book, particularly with the ceremony, ultimately, that you inhale, is just gorgeous. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Well, I have a slightly... because I'm Irish and Catholic, people assume I'm a cradle Catholic, which is not so. My father was an Irish conservative Protestant, and my mother Unitarian, nonconformist. But my father became a Catholic in 1940. He had a nervous breakdown in the army, which he should never have gone into. He should have been in an intelligence, frankly, but he thought he was very patriotic. And his father had been killed at Gallipoli when he was a little boy, and with a war hero for a father, he was determined to go and fight. I mean, it was ridiculous. He was nearly 40, very bad eyesight. So he had a nervous breakdown at the shame of not being able to fight and went into intelligence, which is where he should have been. Mm. But he became a Catholic, and my mother was pretty anti-Catholic at first because she was one of those who the Catholic Church in the Spanish Civil War antagonized with her Unitarian, which
absolutely
is non-Christian, in effect,
right,
background. But so she became a Catholic after 6 years, at which point we children, the younger ones, were just sort of rebaptized. But I was sent to a Catholic convent to see if I wanted to be a Catholic. And actually, I'd always wanted to be a Catholic, and I became one at the age of 14, which is slightly odd because most people, anyway, are either born
much
Catholics
younger, much older.
Or much older, like distinguished Catholics like Evelyn Waugh or Graham Greene, you know.
Sure.
But I became one at 14, and so that was my religious history, which left me very interested in all matters of theology and doctrine, because I learnt them, you know, as a teenager.
Right.
And that was one of the, you were mentioning earlier when we talked earlier, my book about the gunpowder plot. The beginning of all of that was being at school with the girls whose family names were still the names of the old Catholic recusant refusenik families.
Good gosh.
And so I was always interested in these people, the courage of people who refused to compromise their faith, or give up priests, even if it led to imprisonment or worse. So anyway, that was the sort of beginning of my Catholic experience. And cutting right forward, when Harold and I finally got married, we got married in a registry office. And then, sadly, both our former spouses died for different reasons.
Right.
And so technically, in the eyes of the Catholic Church, we were unmarried people. We didn't see it like that, but I thought that, to be honest, that it would be slightly selfish of me not to regularize the position if I was able to from the point of view of the Catholic Church. Because, I mean, none of us know when we are going to die, and it would have been rather unfair on my children not, you know, to think, oh, God, is Mummy, or is she outside the church, or what? So I said to Harold, would you do this? And he was doubtful because he felt he'd already caused pain to his parents marrying two non-Jewish people. His first wife wasn't Jewish.
Right.
Just a footnote, Harold's first wife, distinguished actress Vivian Merchant, he actually got married to her on Yom Kippur. Exactly. And he... Exactly. And he said, of course, he'd absolutely no idea, because he...
He didn't know
he
it
didn't
was young.
No, because he abandoned the Jewish religion after his bar mitzvah. So I said, well, surely you could explain that. He said, no, you don't understand anything. It's far better for me to have done an act of defiance than to have forgotten it was Yom Kippur. But anyway,
but
he said he didn't want to, he felt his parents had passed, he didn't want to really cause them pain. So in fact, a bit later we became very friendly with a Jesuit, and the Jesuits, of course, in South America and Central America, Harold cared very much about human rights.
Sure.
Jesuit had a great record. And
the liberation theology movement.
Exactly. One of my Jesuit friends had been in El Salvador and the rest of it. So Harold agreed, which was very nice of him. And we had a wedding, but we kept it quiet, not partly because it was nobody's business but our own, but also partly I respected his wish not to. I mean, his parents, by that time, we were all very, very friendly.
Sure.
But, you know, it didn't matter to me. I just wanted to go through it. I mean, one of my children, her husband, was a witness. We kept it, and nobody really knew till this book came out. But I saw no reason to hide it.
Mm. Is it, and Father Michael had that beautiful comment when he explained that actually Harold needed to be educated in order to be... to actually go through this?
He said to Harold, because, you know, we had to have a little talking to him, and he said, well, Harold, technically you would need some instruction. I thought, and then Father Michael, being a very tactful man, said, well, I'm sure Antonio will tell you. It was quite a funny ceremony. Blanche was just born. It was 1990. It was 10 years after our civil wedding. So I'm nearly 60, but I had to promise to bring up any children in the Catholic faith. I thought it was rather sweet, like Sarah in the Bible.
But you know, again, for those of us in the theater who therefore are approached to the book and to these stories really is through our reverence for Harold Pinter, the playwright. The idea of him being surrounded by this extraordinary brood of grandchildren that you have. It's not just a lot of children. It's a huge family scene. Indeed, the whole portrait of Pinter that emerges from the book is so romantic, is so familial, is so different from not only what we've taken from his work, but what we've taken from his political speech.
He liked them. I mean, of course, the grandchildren came along a bit later, but he liked small children very much. He had really liked them. There's an idiotic photograph where he's trying to interest Ruby Fraser, daughter of my son Orlando and daughter-in-law Clemmy, in something we called the revolutionary rattle, because he brought it back from Nicaragua for the eldest guy. And little Ruby looks yours truly unimpressed by the revolutionary rattle. I mean, I hope it's still in the book.
Yeah. Yes, it's a gorgeous picture. So could you talk a little bit more about what made you want to be a Catholic at the age of 14? What was the attraction of the Catholic Church?
Ritual of this earth and faith. Faith is a very attractive thing. I sometimes wonder, I'm thinking here of the 17th century, not our own century, but I sometimes wonder how people can write about an age of faith, like the English Civil War, for example, or the Gunpowder Plot, if they've never experienced faith. I don't mean that you have to be very strong in faith, you might have lost your faith, but unless you've had a faith, I don't quite see how you could sort of write about it personally. I'm trying to think of an exception to that.
And that faith is something that you've experienced, that you feel?
Yes, I mean, like everybody's faith, it goes up and down.
Right.
Certainly many things that I might criticize, but that's not to do with faith, that's to do with the sort of worldly emanation of faith.
Exactly. I mean, one of the beautiful things about, as I told Lady Antonia, I've just reread the book that here in the States is called Faith and Treason, I guess, and the Gunpowder Plot in England. It's an extraordinary book, and one of the things that's so moving about it is the sympathy that, and it's a kind of hard-nosed sympathy, if I may say so, because it doesn't feel soft around the edges. It feels like you see very clearly those who are engaged in the Gunpowder Plot, but nonetheless, sympathy for the purity of their motives, even while you're quite analytical about the wrongness of their deeds.
Yes, I wanted to explore why a body of people who were not monsters and not sort of in any way what we'd call professional terrorists, why they were driven to think this was the only thing that they could do. And I'm not at all sympathetic to it, hardly, as you've said. But what I am sympathetic to is an examination of their motives. You know, I think just to, as the government did, torture them to death and then execute them horribly without sort of saying, well, what actually, what are they trying to tell us? I mean, it's a mistake, really. It was very interesting. This book, by the way, I should say, came out in 1996, and I was working on it, therefore, in the early 90s. Sometimes it feels as if it might have come out today, but it didn't.
Well, it was chilling in the depiction, when it was depicting the Catholic recusants and then the actual Catholic terrorists. It's the appropriate word, I think,
yes,
at the time.
Yes, absolutely.
Looking at a persecuted religious minority that felt that they had no other recourse, that it was a completely asymmetrical warfare.
They thought of an act of violence. They wanted to, the plotters wanted to blow up, actually, the House of Lords, but that was the key house, the two houses of Parliament at the time. Therefore, they would blow up a tremendous amount of innocent people, the opening of Parliament. And they wanted to do that because they felt that symbolically this was the only way to sort of bring about a better regime, and they managed to convince themselves that this was a good thing to do and that presumably that it had some kind of almighty blessing. Of course, most of the Catholics of the time were absolutely horrified by this, not just for self-seeking reasons. They knew their lives would get yet worse, and they did. The cause of sort of Catholic liberty was pushed right back. Again, we can see parallels.
Yeah.
Yes, we can see parallels. You know, everybody said every Catholic is a terrorist, whereas actually there were about at most 10 of them,
right.
You know. And the priests who were grabbed and blamed for it, and again, tortured and horrible penalties of execution, the way they did it. But they, getting wind of it, not sure of the details, Father Garnett wrote to Rome and said, could you not please send messages forbidding anyone to take to violence? But of course they paid the penalties.
And you know, I have to say that it's both emotionally moving and intellectually incredibly intriguing looking at the use of the doctrine of equivocation.
Yes.
And how that, and I wonder if you could talk about it, it's extraordinary.
Equivocation was a Jesuit doctrine that if you were apprehended, because the penalty for being a Jesuit was death, and not just death, but, well, a horrible way they chose. Yes, a bad death. Most of us, if asked, captured, are you a priest, would just say no, hoping that, you know, thinking this was justified. But the Jesuits worked out a way of not telling a lie while not telling the truth, equivocation. To give an example, they would be asked, are you a priest? And the priest would reply, no, meaning I'm not a priest of Apollo, you know, and at the temple of Dionysus. I mean, it's idiotic to us in our secure lives, but it's also very brave. As a matter of fact, it had quite an effect on me because I try never to tell a lie. That is, when your friend writes a book and you're not really very keen on it, which happens to everybody who's got a lot of writer's friends, I try to use the equivocating words which are true. I mean, there are famous examples of this, of people saying to actors, I never saw anything like it in my life, you know. That's a bit sort of, which is not a lie, you know. I was instructing my grandchildren at Sunday lunch what equivocation was, and I noticed that their parents, my children, were looking distinctly unimpressed.
But, you know, it's also interesting the fact that the doctrine was then seized upon by
yes.
the government as an example of Jesuitical lying
exactly.
from the hypocrisy, when actually what's so beautiful about it is its attempt to remain moral in
yes.
a completely untenable circumstance.
And it's still, in England anyway, people would say casually that's a pretty Jesuitical argument, exactly. meaning sort of equivocating. Not Catholics, not, you know, ordinary people might say that.
It's very, very, very interesting. Let me change the subject for just a second, Lady Antonia, and ask about your relationship to the theatrical community, because clearly you were literate and cultured and, you know, deeply involved in the life of the mind in Britain before you ever met Harold Pinter. But then suddenly you're ushered into a really extraordinary world of theatrical life over the next 33 years, which make up much of the book as well.
Well, I was ushered, as a result of living with Harold, I was ushered into sort of right inside it. But as a matter of fact, I'd always been mad about the theatre. I was brought up in Oxford, where my father was a don at the university. And in Oxford in the war, we had wonderful theatre because the Blitz meant that the West End, London, was a very dangerous place to open plays. And very often they would open in Oxford and stay in Oxford where we didn't have bombing. So I'd always gone to the theatre, and I went a lot when I first grew up. And in fact, I was on the Evening Standard drama panel. They always had a layperson with the critics, long before I met Harold, and for altogether for 9 years. Mm. And so I wasn't quite as sort of cut off from the theatre as you might suppose.
Right.
And I had one or two friends who were actors and a lot of friends who were playwrights. Mm. I mean, Tom Stoppard was a great friend of mine long before I ever met Harold. Mm.
And it was a world you clearly enjoyed, and it sounds like a world full of riches for you when I read this.
The theatre is an exciting world because it is like politics, but arguably more fun because something is always happening, mm. you know. And I like that. Who doesn't? You like it.
I like it very much. Well, it's just, you know, I wonder if you could talk just a little bit more about what it was like for two strong-willed writers to be living together for 33 years, each extremely successful and extremely productive during that period of time, too.
Well, I think the problem we didn't have was the problem of making our name. I think because I've known, you know, contemporaries, young couples, you know, one, particularly I think two actors living together, the best will in the world, you know, one will draw ahead like two trains. And
there
one will then draw back, one will get work, one won't, and all the rest of it. We simply didn't have that problem. There couldn't be anything competitive. Harold was, as I said, I think 44, but he was, there's a wonderful quote from the English Times, Harold Pinter is arguably the best living playwright. And Harold always added, and plenty of people are arguing about it. And I was a respected biographer, so that we didn't have to sort of make our names, you know. And also we did such completely different things, you know. Again, it wasn't a case of, oh, you've got good reviews and I haven't. It was just absolutely separate. I found it very stimulating, actually.
Right, right.
I loved it when Harold wrote plays and read them to me. It was lovely.
The Harold Pinter that you describe here is a romantic who fills your house with flowers, mm. who writes you poems, and it's you know, one of the things that's so moving about this to me as a very happily married man is watching a married love story that continues right to the very end. And again, very different picture of Pinter than we get from his work or politics.
Well, don't you think? I mean, a lot of people have said that in England, but the fact is, in England, almost everyone is lucky if they can avoid studying Harold's plays at A level or O level, because they're sort of perfect fodder for study, because it isn't obvious what they mean. Everybody right. can have their own interpretation. And also, on the whole, they're not of any particular time and place. You know,
right.
you can't say that The Homecoming is particularly of one particular moment. So that I think people said ambiguous, ambivalent, dark, menacing place. That's the man. But of course, nothing is more mistaken than to equate the artist and the work, really. I mean, I don't think Harold wrote particularly from personal experience. You know, I mean, he'd take things, but I think it was a sort of interior inspiration, judging from the amount of time we lived together. So I think that his cricket team, who knew a jolly fellow, very competitive and very keen on the game and everybody playing up, I think that they saw another side of him. You know, he was extremely athletic.
Right.
Really was proud at school of having been Pinter the Sprinter and having broken records. And that, I think, would take the people who study The Caretaker by surprise.
Absolutely. Amazing. I wonder if, before we open this up to the audience, you'd be willing to read one of the poems that Harold wrote?
Shall I read my favorite poem?
I believe, if that's your favorite...
Oh, you're great. Yes. But you didn't give the title, but I will give the title. I have to put on my glasses. What is the difference between me when Harold and I got together and me now? I now have two pairs of glasses. This is the poem of all of them. I love them all, but the one I like best, because I think what draws it ahead is that it's not a poem by Harold to me, it's a poem by Harold about us. And it's called It Is Here. What sound was that? I turn away into the shaking room. What was that sound that came in on the dark? What is this maze of light it leaves us in? What is this stance we take to turn away and then turn back? What did we hear? It was the breath we took when we first met. Listen, it is here. Quite a lot of people, you know, used to ask Harold and now me, asked to have it read at their wedding. Isn't that nice?
I would too, but I don't need another wedding.
Well, you could have a renewal of vows.
We could do that. Well, perhaps we'll make that deal privately backstage. We'd be happy to open it up if there are questions, Lady Antonia. Anybody? We have a microphone that's floating right behind you, sir.
I hate to inject a note from the sweetness and life, light and romanticism, but as a young man in the 70s, when your affair first started, I can remember reading that Vivian Merchant was aware of the affair and nobody was doing anything about it, and I wondered if there were children. I'm wondering if I read your book, and I intend to, will I see moments of regret about the way this was handled, or don't you think anybody was truly hurt by the affair before you got married?
It's very difficult for me to say. I think that the best thing is to read the book, and you, rather like Harold's plays, mean what you find in them. And I think you'll probably make your own decision. But it seems to me that you're, conceivably, as you haven't read it, muddling up two things. The tabloid reaction, you know, of the dear old tabloids, and sort of hissing headlines. These were not headlines we wished or wrote, you know, and it's a horrible experience to be persecuted by the tabloids, but I always bore in mind, and somebody could Google it. Anybody here got a BlackBerry? Because I don't know who said these words, living well is the best revenge.
Murphy. George Murphy. George Murphy.
Thank you. Thank you. And that's true. I mean, the tabloids could hiss like snakes, and they got bored after a bit, went and hissed at someone else. But we had our love to keep us together and keep going.
And so the spouses and the children weren't terribly hurt by this.
I'm sorry? Sorry?
I think let's move on to the next question. Rather.
No, I mean, the answer is no.
I came in a little late, so I don't know if you discussed this early on, but I was just wondering, what were your emotions as you wrote the book? Did you run the full gamut of emotions? Was it a joyful experience, reliving all the memories? and then looking at them again from today's perspective?
Yes and no. I mean, I had lost Harold a month before I started it, and a lot of it was extremely joyful, reliving the wonderful times we had, you know, his achievements and all the rest of it. For instance, notably the day he won the Nobel Prize, which was tremendously exciting, the most exciting day. Very nice. On his behalf, I acknowledge it. Of course, hanging over me when I started was the fact that I had to write about his 7 years of illness. He was first diagnosed with illness almost 7 years to the day with esophageal cancer before he actually died of another cancer. And that was hanging over me, and I was dreading it. And then I thought, you know, there's only one thing to do if you dread something, and that is to do it. So after I wrote the first part, it's in three parts, the first part, I then skipped forward and wrote the last part so that it wouldn't hang over me. And then I wrote the middle part, where I'm behaving much more as a sort of biographer. It's more impressionistic, you know, done by topics, and not one thing after another. So it was mingled. But on the whole, I would say it was joy and recollection and contentment. And even with the very difficult in the sense of having to write about a very painful course of his illness, 7 years, a long time, there were moments not only tremendous joy and excitement, but also I was so impressed by his fortitude when I came to read my diary entries. And you may say, well, didn't you notice the fortitude? Well, of course I did, but I was so busy sort of trying to do what you're supposed to do, lead one day at a time, as everybody, live one day at a time, as everybody tells you to, that perhaps the full picture hadn't been apparent to me. So it was sort of mingled. But basically, I'm delighted I did it. And of course, talking about Harold is a pure pleasure. It sort of brings him back, you know. And I meet people who remembered him. I was doing an interview with Diane Rehm this morning in Washington, and one or two people came out of his past and remembered directors, and it was marvellous and so enjoyable. Mm.
Yes.
Obviously, a 30-plus-year marriage is very successful, but I wonder if you would share with us some of the things that you fussed or fought about.
Some of the things I will.
That you fought about, disagreements you had.
I think fought is too strong.
She also used the word fussed.
Fussed. I didn't know. I used to. I'm trying to think. We were pretty harmonious. Harold was domestically very angelic, which was just as well, because I am not a domestic goddess at all. So it was lucky that he wasn't looking for that. Harold was extremely fastidious. He had this horror of flies. A real sort of, I think a therapist, I don't know where it would have come from, but he was very, and I'm sort of more languid, oh, poor old flies, you know, they mean well in their own horrible way, you know, sort of relax. I think that kind of thing. And also, so I was a member of a large family, one of eight children myself, and he was an only child, adoring Jewish parents, marvellous food. I mean, wonderful. Harold's mother, when she decided I was a good thing, she started to send me placating presents of chopped liver, which I loved, you know. I love chopped liver. I mean, he'd had a much more orderly life than I ever had. Mm. And I was used to retiring into my room and making my order, as people who live with a lot of other people do. And he liked quiet. In fact, when he wrote Betrayal, the first play he wrote after we were together, I think it was coming into the house and finding one of my sons was home for half term from boarding school, and with all his friends they were in the kitchen having a whale of good time of people 15 do. And Harold rushed upstairs, shut the door, and started to write a play. And so I said, oh, well, if that's the effect half term has on you, we'll have more half terms.
Amazing. One of the things that you repeat, come back to several times, is not letting the sun go down.
Oh, yes. We had this motto. do not let, I think it's in the Bible, do not let the sun go down upon your wrath. And although we had some pretty late sunsets, we stuck to it. I'm a great believer in that, you see. If you go to bed with a grievance and in anger, it's very bad because then it curdles in your mind throughout the night and you wake up probably angrier. Whereas if you're reconciled and you agree that they're absolutely right, except you're even righter, you know, that kind of reconciliation, then you have the night hours and everything soothes. This is my recipe for a happy marriage. Anybody interested?
We're all writing it down. Yes.
Hi, may I ask about another book?
Of course.
I think I always forget the name, but The Weaker Vessel, the one about women in the 17th century. How much were you influenced by having gone to a convent school? And are things better for non-Catholic girls in England of the upper classes?
Better than they were in the 17th century. Yes. No, I'm sorry, it wasn't a smart answer. I just meant, when you said better, I wasn't quite sure what you meant. Where are you? I can't see. Oh, there, sorry. Sorry, just so I can answer the question, when you said better than when?
Well, better than the 17th century, and there still seems to be a lack of emphasis on education for some girls of the upper classes.
Yes.
Who aren't Catholic.
I think that has finally passed, and about time, too. But I was unusual going to Oxford, and my mother went to Oxford comparatively early undergraduate, and therefore she thought I should go to Oxford too. So, you know, you see a clever mother propels a daughter in that direction. But very few of my contemporaries at this convent went to university. They were quite clever enough, but it just wasn't the mode. I thought that was very sad. I mean, two of my three daughters went to university, and the third one actually positively didn't want to. So that was sort of liberty. But going back to The Weaker Vessel, I was very gratified. That book was tremendously successful in this country, and I was very gratified and grateful. It was ahead of its time in England. I mean, this country is so far ahead of England in its attitude to women's liberties, going back to the 19th century. Have you ever read de Tocqueville? Or indeed Fanny Trollope, both of them, the 19th century, point to the liberty of American women. Different laws. American women had much better property rights much earlier. And it was significant with this book that in England it hardly did anything, and here it was a bestseller. Now, of course, it's a sort of text in England. But I really enjoyed doing it. I really enjoyed ferreting out these unknown women. It's all very well writing about tragic queens, and I like doing that too. But finding the diary of a woman, or letters, you know, of a woman who was barely literate, that was also extremely exciting.
Right back over here.
Hi. I was just wondering about the relationship between the writing you do of biographies and other women's diaries and letters, and then what, not editing your own diaries, but what keeping your diary, what function that personal writing served, and how it was different or how it might have changed over the course of keeping it, in particular whether you write a diary with an eye to an audience or
I tell you what, when I started to write this book in the spring of 2009, as I said, I write about the first 6 weeks of it. I write about writing the book and what I felt. And I'm very glad I did that. I've got a record. Obviously, the book stops with Harold's life. But then I found it just too self-referential. I could not write a diary about a woman writing a diary about you know. And so I stopped. And I didn't go back until September. I went back to more my pre-diary way of, if something very interesting outside happened, then I might write about it. But in a way, it's not quite the same. It's not to say I won't go back to doing it, but at the moment, not. I mean, producing this book seemed to satisfy that side of me for the time being anyway.
Thank you for this. It's been wonderful. I'm very interested in your family. You spoke of your mother being clever and the effect on you. I liked her memoirs very much, The Pebbled Shore, I think it's called. And she spoke with great pride of her children. I think she called you the wonder child or something like that, because you were such a phenomenon in Oxford.
Well, I was the eldest, you know. That.
Yes, I know that. She made very clear that you were the pride of the litter at that point. But I was just wondering how conscious you, your family, and in the generation of your children are of this writing, specifically writing fate that your family seems to have. Was this on purpose, or did it just develop naturally?
I think I have to refer you to the chronology, which is slightly different. In my youth, neither of my parents wrote books. Both of them stood for Parliament. My mother wanted to be an MP just as much as my father. My father was finally made a Lord and thus a Labour Minister. And my mother gave up trying. I think even she found 8 children too much the thought of going into Parliament. But she regretted it. I mean, not regretted it, she missed it. For a very charitable woman, she was curiously uncharitable about women MPs. I mean, her feelings about Margaret Thatcher were not really to her credit, sort of almost, well, she couldn't be quite, but she could come very near to being bitchy, actually. And even Barbara Castle, the Labour politician, she wasn't quite as keen on as she might have been. So politics was what obsessed my parents. As I say, my mother wrote her first major book, Queen Victoria. It's a wonderful book. When I was 34 with 4 children, 5 children, so that it didn't. Writing was really something that I did myself. You know, I think if you're a member of a large family, you're always looking for little things of your own. It then so happened that my mother developed, having given up politics, she looked for a new career and became an extremely successful historical biographer. My father's books were a very interesting man and a great penal reformer and a great believer in redemption of people. His books are really the least interesting thing about him because he dictated them. He had very, very bad eyesight quite soon, dictated them and was not able to correct them. So there were some rather odd things in his books, but that wasn't his sin. And my brothers and sisters wrote after me, not, I may quickly say, in imitation of me, because they wrote different things. So it's sort of, it looks as if we all wrote, but as children, nobody wrote except me, and nor did my parents.
Yes.
These detailed diaries I started to keep in October 1968. I'd handed in the manuscript of Mary, Queen of Scots, my first historical book, and it had been the centre of my life for so long, the thing that kept me going with all the ups and downs of life. And suddenly there it wasn't. It had gone. And I looked around for something to do. I had a feeling which I sort of felt to be postnatal, you know, that sort of letdown. Where's the baby? And the baby had gone off to the printer. And so I started to write. That was 7 years before I met Harold.
As a great fan of your historical books, there's a question that has never been cleared in my mind. For example, Queen Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen. Mm. Did abortion exist in those times? Was there, in fact, some recourse, or have we never really known that?
I tell you something, that abortion and contraception have existed in their own different ways as long as there have been relationships. The way they existed, herbs, you know, handbooks, old wives' hands. I mean, they used to give recipes full of weeds and nettles and whatever, and then say, on no account take this if you have a child because you'll miscarry, well, you can see through that one, you know. And in the same way, some of the methods of contraception seem absolutely extraordinary to us. I mean, they had it in ancient Egypt, because where there's a need, i.e. to have sex without procreating, you're going to have a solution. It may not be the kind of solutions we have now, but it's always existed. I mean, you know, people, when they started a baby that they didn't want, possibly because it wasn't their husband's, well, this is not true of the Virgin Queen, of course. There were many ways and many people who'd come and help them. Not very not very salubrious, but they did exist.
A virgin.
My own theory about her is that we must not think black and white. You mustn't think in those days, just because the most popular method of contraception was withdrawal, coitus interruptus. And how do we know? Because the preachers were always condemning it, you see, and always saying, don't do it. So clearly people were doing it. I think probably in her relationship with Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, there was probably a lot of what we might call foreplay, you know. I would say, however, that they didn't have full consummation. We'll never know, but that's what I think.
Are we likely to ever get your biography of Elizabeth?
No, we are not likely ever to get it.
That's a loss for us.
Well, I tell you what, when I finished this book, the book that only I could write, I found that Elizabeth was dead. I had nothing new to say. There are many great books about Elizabeth, and in fact, a much younger friend of mine, a historian, said, are you really not going to do it, because I might do it? And I said, go ahead, it's a wonderful subject. But all my enthusiasm had gone into Mary Queen of Scots, the bit I write about Elizabeth in my Warrior Queens, and in the Gunpowder Plot, you know, in a way, and the Six Wives of Henry VIII, which is obviously about at the point that Henry dies. She's Elizabeth, born in 33, she's 14 or 15, and has already had sort of experiences with Thomas Seymour, etc. So I just found, with me, I have to feel zest. And if I don't feel zest, there's not going to be a good book, and who needs a bad book?
Do you have any idea what you will feel zest for, Lydia?
Well, who knows? I'll do another book, that I do
know. Thank you. We have that on tape now, so. Other questions?
I was touched to read at the beginning of the affair, when you were first falling in love, that Pinter said to you that he saw you living your lives together forever and ever, and you said, well, but what about younger women? And I thought it was kind of cute, because you were younger. But you're
No, that was my mother.
Oh, that was your mother.
My mother. She persisted in giving me a lot of awful warnings. And she said, well, you know, this is all very... my parents had this obsession that the theatre was full of dangerous people, I think it was. She said, well, you'll fall in love with a younger woman. And I repeated it that night to Harold, who said, certainly not. I'm 18 years old. I like mature women, and that's the way I'm going to stay.
That's what I was going to ask you. So do you feel like he was an 18-year-old? Just describe some things about him that felt youthful forever.
Well, I think his energy was youthful, and his interest in life. And that was what was very touching and painful about the last 7 years, that he wouldn't give up. You know, he acted in Crap's Last Tape, you know, that monologue by Beckett, wonderful piece at the Royal Court, only 2 years before he died, when he was going to hospitals. So I think he did have sort of youthful interest in life, and that his interest in politics, whether you agree with him or not, meant that he felt engaged. On October the 10th, recently passed, he would have been 80. I don't know what tense you use. You know, it's 80th anniversary. We went to Dublin, the Gate Theatre had a sort of little mini Pinter festival. And it's a very odd thought to me of Harold being 80. I know he was 78 when he died. But I just somehow couldn't imagine. But then 80, shortly to be upon me, sounds so tremendously old. But, of course, once I'm 80, I'll think, well, 90's awfully old. You know, we sort of move up.
I have to say, your description of the performances of Crap's Last Tape have now moved that evening onto one of the evenings that I would give anything to go back and be able to see it. Sounds like
it's on CD, you know, DVD. I mean,
well, then,
have you ever seen it?
Then I'll give $14.99 to, yes, to go back.
Well,
but
I'm,
to actually be present in the theater is a different thing.
No, I know. I quite agree with you, and I want to say something about that. But actually, it so happens, having seen it almost every performance of its very short run, it's one of the things that really translated well onto DVD. Mm. Trust me, what you see really is almost, of course, it never can be the same. But it was the hottest ticket in town because it was praised on the front page of the New York Times. And I was going along one evening, and there was an American man who said, I'm absolutely determined to see this. I've come specially to see it. And he recognized me and said, now, look, you've seen this play lots of times. I'll give you $250. And I thought, oh, that's rather nice, but how on earth would I explain to Harold? So I didn't take the money.
It's one of the things that comes through so strongly in those last years is your description of how his sense of life was tied to projects,
yes,
tied to work.
Yeah.
And it's moving, at times painful to watch it when he can't do it, but we actually share in his excitement, those moments when he decides the crazy monkeys to convince him to do something.
In Crabbe's Last Tape, which was directed by a very distinguished director, Ian Rickson, who I think, didn't his Seagull come
in? He did Seagull here, the former, yeah, artistic director of the Royal Court.
Yes, so exactly.
Wonderful,
and he
wonderful
directed
director.
It. He was no longer artistic director, that was already Dominic Cook, but he wanted to do it. And what my diary does chronicle, and I've left most of it in, is Harold's determination to do it if he could, but determination not to do it badly because of his respect for Beckett, you know, his hero, if you like. And I remember Ian saying to me, I'm worrying whether he's strong enough, and he's worrying about whether he's too weak, you know. And Ian was wonderfully sensitive because he said to me, you know, you've got to realise it could be cancelled at the last minute. There's nothing that can't be cancelled. You know, he mustn't ever think he's got to do it. So that kind of encouragement. But, you know, he wanted to do it.
Yeah. It's actually that one of the scenes that I'll never forget in the book is when he's explaining to Beckett that none of his work is political, and
yeah,
Beckett has explained to him that all theater is political. It's just, I would have loved to be a fly on the wall for that conversation.
The funniest exchange was when I was, we were in Paris, and Beckett and Harold were having a drink at his favorite cafe. Is it the Coupole? It's very well known. Or the Cafe Floor, one or the other. And my son Damien was a student in Paris before going to university. I think he was about 17, had been at Ampleforth. And he and I went to a cinema, and then we were going to meet up. And Damien was thrilled to meet Beckett, you know. And we got into a traffic block. We got later and later and later. And Beckett, who generally went off at a certain time, didn't really eat, just went home. His perfect manners, he stayed, because he could see that Damon would have been told, you're going to meet Beckett. It was so nice. And then when they met, instead of discussing fine art, they discussed rugger, because Damon was a great rugger player. And I asked Harold how the conversation went, and he said, well, at one point I said, oh, Sam, I'm tremendously gloomy about the world. And Sam Beckett said, oh, Harold, you can't be more gloomy than I am. And I said, that's exactly what people think Pinter and Beckett go on about.
That's beautiful.
Is Beckett done here much?
Beckett is done here a lot.
Good.
Beckett is revered.
He's done a lot in England, I'm glad to say.
Absolutely. Anything else before we... we'll have one more.
Assuming that arrangements have already been made for Mr. Pinter's papers, Where have you decided your papers are going to be?
Harold, first of all, lent his papers to the British Library because he had all his manuscripts except one, which is in some American university, which a Pinter scholar would tell you, it's sort of he gave it for charity or something. But he lent them to the British Library because he was worried about the security. You can't insure papers, you know, they've got no value and every value at the same time. And then in the last years, he sold them. He was very happy with that. There are places he could have got more than the British Library, but he was patriotic. He thought that was the right place for them to be. So I, my manuscripts, the manuscripts of a historical biographer are not so interesting. I'm not saying this about myself, just as a matter of fact, compared to a creative artist's manuscript. I mean, it is riveting to see Harold's manuscript, for instance, of the homecoming, you know, crossing out and betrayal and all the titles he thought of using. Wow. And they're very, very popular. People go and check up on them all the time. So I just simply put my own manuscripts there. And I expect one day my diaries will be offered to them by my literary executor. It seems to be the right place for them. But for the time being, there they sit at home.
I want to thank Lady Antonia Fraser.